Good morning, dear Sangha. Today is Wednesday, the 28th of December in the year 2011. We are in the New Hamlet in the Full Moon Meditation Hall. The sun is shining. In Plum Village, we have a song that says, "Waking up this morning, I smile." I join my palms to express my gratitude because I see the 24 brand new hours are before me like a gift. Every morning when we wake up, the gift is there. 24 brand new hours. And there are those among us who know how to allow that gift to bring us a lot of happiness. 24 hours to live is an amazing gift. Among us, there are those who have many talents. We can organize a picnic. We can organize a party, a celebration. We can organize a retreat. I think we should learn how to organize a day, to live it well with happiness. There is suffering in us and around us, in the world around. There are people who wish to go find a place where there is no suffering, like the Pure Land of the Buddha or the Kingdom of God. We may think that up there, there is no suffering, there is only happiness. But when we look deeply, we see that happiness and suffering inter are. Just as the mud and the lotus. If there is no mud, there is no lotus flower. There is a very close connection between suffering and happiness. Happiness is possible when we have the right view of suffering and happiness. It's just like the right and the left. The right cannot exist without the left. The left cannot exist without the right. So, happiness and suffering inter are. Happiness is made of non-happiness elements, just as the flower is made of non-flower elements. When you look at the flower, you see the non-flower elements. Non-flower elements like light, rain, like the earth, they have come together to help the flower to manifest. So when we look into a flower, we see nothing but non-flower elements. And if we take out any of those non-flower elements, there is no longer a flower. Happiness is a kind of flower. If you look deeply into happiness, you see non-happiness elements, including suffering. Suffering plays a very important role in happiness. Just like when we look into the lotus, we see the mud. Without the mud, there is no lotus. This view of happiness is the right view. The first teaching that the Buddha gave regarding suffering was also about happiness. In the first talk he gave, he talked about the first truth. The first truth, which is suffering, ill-being. He said there is a path leading to ill-being. So the path leading to ill-being, that is the second noble truth. We may ask ourselves, what's so noble about this truth of suffering? Is suffering noble? The answer is yes, because thanks to suffering we can recognize happiness. Thanks to understanding suffering, we can find the way, the path of emancipation. If we have the courage to look deeply into the suffering, we will see the path leading to the cessation, to the transformation of suffering. But if we continue trying to escape from suffering, we will have no chance. So we hold that suffering before us. We look deeply into the nature of that suffering. That's the practice. Suffering, ill-being, that's the first truth. And looking into the nature of suffering to see how the suffering was made, that's the second truth. So it's not exactly philosophy, it's a practice. Recognizing suffering, looking deeply into the causes of suffering, these are the first and second noble truths. The third truth is about the cessation of suffering. That also means the beginning of happiness, well-being. So, according to the teaching, well-being, happiness is something possible. The cessation, the transformation of suffering is something possible. That's the third truth. And of course, there is a path that leads to happiness, to the cessation of suffering. And that path is the fourth noble truth. So the teaching given by the Buddha spoke of the four truths: ill-being, the path leading to ill-being, well-being, and the path leading to well-being. So the teaching of the Buddha talks about suffering and happiness, well-being and ill-being, both. path that leads to the cessation of suffering leads to well-being is called the right path. We will talk about the right path. There is the word Dao. It means the path. And a path. This path consists of 8 practices. It's the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path, that first character in Chinese means 8. And it begins with right view. We have already seen that right view. With right view, we can see the nature of interbeing of all things. When we look into the flower, we can see, realize that the flower is made only of non-flower elements. That is already right view. When we look into the lotus flower, we see the mud. That is already right view. And with right view of suffering, with right view, suffering begins to transform right away. For example, in relationships, we may feel like the victim of the other person, we suffer. We think the other person isn't suffering at all. The other person is only making other people suffer. That view cannot be qualified as right view. If we look into our own suffering attentively, if we have a little bit of concentration, during the deep looking directed at our own suffering, we can see the elements that have come together to produce that suffering. And when we look into the other person, we see that suffering also inhabits that person. There's a suffering in us. There is suffering in him or in her. But if we don't understand our own suffering, if we cannot see into the nature of that suffering, we don't have the right view on suffering and we continue to suffer. But if we have the time to look deeply into our own suffering, we will discover the elements that have helped produce that suffering. We begin to see clearly and establish right view. When we don't understand suffering, when we don't know how to handle suffering, we continue to suffer. And we will continue to make the other person suffer. If we look at the other person with a little bit of mindfulness and concentration, we will realize that there is suffering in him and her. And that person doesn't know how to handle his or her suffering. That person is afraid of his or her suffering. That person doesn't have the capacity to embrace the suffering, to look deeply into the nature of his or her suffering. That person doesn't understand her own, his own suffering, doesn't understand the nature of interbeing of that suffering. So he or she continues to suffer and to make the other person suffer. Maybe she doesn't mean to make you suffer. She doesn't have that intention. Just like you, you don't have the intention to make that person suffer. But you still make him suffer, her suffer. Because if you know how to handle your own suffering, if you know how to transform your own suffering, you will be able to help the other person to do the same. So you just look. You look into yourself, into the suffering that's there in you, and you look into the other person and the suffering in him or her. And with a little bit of mindfulness, a little bit of concentration, you will discover the nature of that suffering. The fact that you can see that suffering is there in him or her, that that person doesn't know how to deal with their suffering. And that's why you are becoming the second victim. That view is already right view. And when you can recognize the suffering in her and him, that person does not need to be punished. He or she needs help. And if you can see that, then you already have right view. And that right view makes you suffer much less right away. Instead of trying to punish that person for making you suffer, because when you suffer, you want to use punishment to make yourself suffer less. You want to punish that person for having dared to make you suffer. But if you can see already the suffering in the other person, when you know that that person just can't handle their own suffering, they're the victim of their own suffering, then that intention to punish goes away, and you can have another feeling. You can obtain the kind of understanding, the kind of right view. That person needs my help. She's suffering. He doesn't know how to handle that suffering. He needs help. And maybe I can help. This idea, this understanding makes you suffer less right away. So, right view works right away. We need to cultivate right view. Cultivating right view is a daily work. When we listen, when we do things, we do everything with attention, with mindfulness, and with concentration. With attention, with mindfulness, and concentration, we will be able to recognize what is happening in the moment, look deeply into what is happening, and in that way, right view can spring up. So right view is the fruit of the practice. Right concentration, right mindfulness. In meditation, we practice concentration. Concentration is always concentration on something. And concentration is cultivated in our daily life. For example, when you look at a flower, and if you bring your attention to that flower, that is mindfulness. The flower appears in your mindfulness as something real. Breathing in, I see that the flower is there, a wonder of life. Mindfulness helps us to recognize what is there in us and around us. With the practice of mindful breathing, mindful walking, we bring our mind back to our body. And when the body and the mind are together, we can establish ourselves in the here and the now. And in the here and now, we can get in touch with all the things of life. So we can say, breathing in, I am aware that my body is here. Because many of us forget that we have a body. So breathing in, coming back to our body, and getting in touch with our body, that is already mindfulness. Mindfulness that my body is here and it is a wonder. There isn't only the body, there are also feelings, emotions, perceptions. Mindfulness helps us to get in touch with all those things that are going on. Contemplation of the body, contemplation of the feelings, contemplation of perceptions, etc. Body, feelings, perceptions, these are objects of mindfulness. And there are objects of mindfulness that have the function of nourishing and healing us. There are many wonderful things in us and around us. Every morning when we wake up, we breathe. That's mindfulness. And we get in touch with the wonders of life that are in us and around us. There are things that are wonderful, that can nourish and heal us. And so mindfulness gets us in touch with those things for our own healing and happiness. So that is the first function of mindfulness. Joy gives us joy and happiness. Mindfulness. And when you are in touch, a painful feeling, something that's not going well, a strong emotion, a catastrophe, mindfulness will help you to be aware of it. And you can do something to soothe, to calm that pain. So mindfulness puts you in touch with positive things, and it can also put you in touch with the things that are painful. You may have anger. If you're not a practitioner, you let that anger ravage your mind and body. But if you are a practitioner, you can breathe mindfully and come back to the present moment. Get in touch with your body, with your feelings. Breathing in, I know that anger is there in me. Mindfulness helps you to be in touch with the anger. There is already a difference. If you're not a practitioner, there's just the anger, just that one energy in us. And that energy can push us to say and to do things that will cause damage. But you are a practitioner. So when the anger comes up, you practice. You practice mindful breathing. And you generate the energy of mindfulness. Breathing in, I know anger is there in me. So there is the energy of anger, but there's also the energy of mindfulness that's being produced and is recognizing the anger. And not only that, the energy of mindfulness can embrace the anger. My little anger, I'm here for you. I'm going to take good care of you. That's what you do as a practitioner. Mindfulness is already the Buddha. And when the Buddha is there, there is nothing to fear. Because the Buddha will help you to handle that suffering. The essential thing is to light up your mindfulness. You have that second energy that can recognize the suffering or the anger and gently, tenderly embrace that pain. So the practitioner in that moment has two energies operating, the suffering energy and the mindfulness that recognizes and embraces that suffering. And if you practice in this way, you will obtain a relief very quickly. Just like a mom who hears her baby cry in its room The mommy goes into the room. She picks up her baby and embraces that baby with a lot of tenderness. And with that tenderness, it begins to penetrate into the body of the baby. Right away, the baby suffers less. It's the same thing with the baby of your own suffering. When your suffering baby manifests, you are the mom with your mindfulness. You can be there for your suffering baby. Hello, my little anger. I'm still here. I'm always here for you. With the practice of walking or breathing, you generate that energy of mindfulness to recognize and to embrace with tenderness, with gentleness, that pain in you. This is an art. And there is a relief. That is the second function of mindfulness. With mindfulness, we can nourish and heal ourselves with positive things. With mindfulness, we can embrace and relieve suffering. And when you are fully aware of what is there, and if you can maintain, keep that concentration alive, you keep the mindfulness alive, then the concentration arises. Because when you are mindful of the flower, of the presence of that flower, and if you maintain that awareness, that mindfulness, so that it lasts, is sustained, then that is concentration. So concentration is something that is born of mindfulness. In fact, the energy of mindfulness is the bearer of concentration. If you practice mindfulness deeply, concentration reveals itself. With concentration, you're able to look deeply into what is there. And you will make a breakthrough into reality, and you will get right view. So in a practice center, everyone lives in such a way that they can generate the energy of mindfulness, of concentration, and right view. And these are energies that bring us happiness. When we've got right view, then we can practice right thinking. Right thinking is thinking characterized by non-discrimination, because we talked about suffering and happiness. And we have already seen that between suffering and happiness there is a very deep connection. Because we see that the flower is made only of non-flower elements, because we know that there is mud in the lotus flower. That's why we no longer believe that happiness can be there in an absence of suffering. So the idea, the thought that there is a place where suffering doesn't exist and there's only happiness, that is not right thinking. That thinking is not right because it is not based on right view. According to right view, there is no happiness without suffering. Thinking can make us suffer. Thinking can also make us free. We need right thinking to stop our suffering and to begin to be happy. For example, several people are living in the same environment, and among those people living in the same environment, there are some people who are happy and others who are unhappy. Let's suppose we look outside the meditation hall and we see the sun. The vegetation, the fog. There are those among us who have the ability to appreciate the presence of the sun. And we can get in touch with the sun, with the vegetation, all the wonders of life. But maybe there are some people who don't have the ability to get in touch with the wonderful things that surround us and that are also inside us. And for those people, they only see suffering. The conditions of their life are exactly the same. But why are there some people who are happy and others who are not happy? The answer is, the one who is happy has the right view. And the other person is suffering because he doesn't have the right view. So his thinking is not right thinking. Suffering is something that is relative. Something may be a suffering for one person, but that very same thing may not be suffering for another person. When we speak of birth, aging, illness, and death, we see that those four things could be described as nothing but a mass of suffering. There are people who say, why was I born like that? Birth is suffering. Why be born? There's too much suffering. For that person, birth is suffering. There are others among us who celebrate birth. Happy birthday. We celebrate birth. Sickness, aging, and death are described as suffering. There was a Vietnamese nun who wrote a poem in the 12th century about suffering. Here's what she said. Birth, aging, sickness and death, these are natural. They belong to life. If there is life, there are those four things. We shouldn't try to get out of them. These are natural. Because life is there, those four things are there. If those four things are not there, then life is not there. Life is birth, is aging, is sickness, is death. So for Al, for her, birth is not suffering. These things are not suffering. So with concentration, with meditation, we can touch our nature of no death. Death is, first of all, a notion. To die, when we speak of dying, we're talking about disappearing, about passing from being to non-being. You are someone, and then when death comes, you become no one. You are in the realm of being, and by death you pass into the realm of non-being. That is a view. And according to Buddhism, that is a view that is not right view. If we get in touch deeply with things, we see that the nature of things is the nature of no birth and no death. When we look at a cloud, we see that a cloud has not gone from non-being into being. Before being there in the form of a cloud, it was there in other forms. The cloud has not come from nothingness, from non-being. If we look deeply into the nature of the cloud, we see that its former life, in its former life, the cloud had been ocean water, the sunlight, these kinds of things. So its nature is really no birth, unborn, because it has not gone from non-being into being. So this form of cloud is just a new manifestation, but it is really a continuation. It is not a beginning from nothing. There is no birth, there is no beginning for that cloud. A cloud actually has no beginning, no birth. And when a cloud disappears, it doesn't die, because when we say die, we mean to pass from the realm of being into the realm of non-being. But it is impossible for a cloud to do that. A cloud may become rain or snow, hail, but a cloud cannot die, cannot become nothing, non-being. And if you can perceive this reality, it means the undying nature of the cloud, then you can see that death doesn't have to be suffering, because death doesn't really exist. The physical sciences have also seen the same thing. If we talk about the law of conservation of matter or energy, we see that nothing is created and nothing is ever lost. Like in a chemical reaction, we can see something disappear, but if we count the atoms, we will see that the number of atoms going into the reaction and the number of atoms coming out of the reaction, those numbers are identical. So there is no death, there is no birth. So for those who have been able to touch the true nature of things, the nature of no birth and no death, for those people, death does not really exist. Not really. We cannot qualify death as a suffering, because these are just notions. So in Buddhism, we have the practice of concentration, which is very important. There are all kinds of practices of concentration, but in all Buddhist traditions, you can find the practice of the three doors of liberation, which is concentration on emptiness, shunyata, that is the practice of concentration. And then concentration, sign lesson, signlessness. Aimlessness. Emptiness does not mean non-existence. There's a big difference between emptiness and non-being. Non-being is empty, but being is also empty. When we speak of emptiness, we may say, this cup is empty. But that doesn't mean that the cup isn't there. So emptiness and non-existence are two different things. In the heart of perfect understanding, it is said, form is emptiness. But emptiness is form. Very clear. In order not to fall into extremes of being and non-being, if we say form is emptiness, we may tend to think that the form, like our body, doesn't exist. So that's why the sutra goes on to say, and emptiness is form. So we don't fall into these two extremes of being and non-being. Suppose that flower is not empty. It is impossible for a flower not to be empty. Because we look into the flower, we see that the flower is made of only non-flower elements. So the flower is full of non-flower elements. Everything in the cosmos is united in that flower. That flower contains the entire cosmos. The sun, the moon, the earth. All of those things are right there in the flower. So it's more easy to say the flower is full of the whole cosmos. And our body is the same. Our body is a kind of flower. It contains the cosmos, the whole cosmos. Because non-form elements came together to produce this form. So it is full of the whole cosmos. But at the same time, it is empty of something. And that something is a separate existence. If you remove all the non-flower elements and send them back to the sun, to the cloud in the sky, the soil back to the earth, then there's no more flower. There's no more flower. So a flower is made only of non-flower elements. It is empty of a separate existence. So in Buddhism we have the word interbeing. You cannot be by yourself. You have to interbe with the whole cosmos. So to be is to interbe. And emptiness means there is no separate existence. There is no self. We are conditioned things. The flower, we ourselves, we are conditioned. We are made of non-us elements, just like the flower. This is the contemplation on emptiness. When we look into this piece of paper, which is also empty, let's say we speak of the front and the back side. That the front side is not the back side, that's clear. But if you remove the front, the back is no longer there. So the front is not the enemy of the back. In fact, the front is made of the back. It's just like the left and the right. The left cannot be there without the right, and vice versa. And when we apply this to father and son, the father and son are actually born in the same time, just like the front and the back. It's not right view to say that the back existed first and gave birth to the front, or the other way around. Those things manifest simultaneously. So there's the word interbe. It is impossible to be by yourself. Everything inter is. Co-being. In Sanskrit is the word sahabhu. And this is the word in Chinese. Bu means existence, being, and saha means together. This is here because that is there. If this were not here, that could not be there. That is interbeing. When you are called daddy, father, it's because you have a child, a son or a daughter. If your son or daughter has not yet appeared, then you are not called father. So father and child manifest in the same moment. Before being daddy, you may be brother or son, husband, but you're not father. So the father is born in the same moment as the child. So between father or mother and child, there is the nature of interbeing. And when you look deeply into the nature of the child, you see the parent. When you look deeply into the parent, you see the child. The child is made of non-child elements. The parent is also made of non-parent elements, including the child. So the child and the parent exist in this sahabhu, this interbeing. Right view. One time the Buddha offered us a definition of right view. One day a monk named Kacayana came to ask the Buddha about this. Dear teacher, you have spoken several times about right view. What is right view? The Buddha said that right view is the view that transcends notions of being and non-being. And he continued to explain. The first thing he said was that right view is the view that transcends the notions of being and non-being. The notions of being and non-being may bring a lot of suffering, a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. And these are nothing but ideas. They are notions. The ultimate reality cannot be described in terms of being and non-being. It is said that the Buddha's teachings begin with the teaching on suffering. And when we suffer, we ask ourselves why we suffer. And when we confirm the existence of suffering, we must also confirm the existence of its opposite, which is happiness. And when we look deeply, we see that suffering is made of non-suffering elements and happiness also. When we look into suffering, we can see birth. And to birth, we can see death. And the Buddha advises us to look in such a way that we can transcend the notions that suffering and happiness, our birth and death, are opposites, unrelated. The key is interbeing. The practice of concentration on emptiness, signlessness, and aimlessness. This meditation belongs to the contemplation on emptiness and signlessness. We've already spoken about the nature of the cloud. A cloud. Does not pass from non-being into being. And when the cloud is no longer seen, it is not passing from being into non-being. So looking deeply, we see that birth and death are nothing but notions. And when we have been able to observe that birth and death are nothing other than notions, we can also at the same time transcend the notion of being and the notion of non-being. Because in our mind, to be born is to pass from non-being into being. And to die in our head, it means from being we pass into non-being. If we can remove the notions of birth and death, then we remove at the same time the notions of being and non-being. Suppose we continue with the cloud. The sign, the appearance, nimitta. We recognize a cloud thanks to its appearance, the sign that it represents. But we can get caught in that appearance. And when we no longer see that cloud in the sky, we think the cloud has died. The cloud has passed from being into non-being. But in fact, the cloud is still there in another form, another appearance, such as the rain. The rain is a continuation of the cloud. If you are in love with the cloud, and if the cloud is no longer there, you cry. But the cloud that has become rain is calling out to you, "Darling, darling, I'm still here." So if you practice concentration on signlessness, you don't suffer. You know it is impossible for your cloud to die. It's still there for you. So you are used to recognizing your beloved in one particular form, one appearance or sign, and then one day your beloved changes the sign and you cry because you are caught in the sign, you're caught in the appearance. So this teaching is to no longer get caught in appearances. So when you drink your tea, mindfulness and concentration tell you, my cloud is still here. I'm still deeply in touch with my cloud. And you are in touch with the unborn, undying nature of your beloved cloud. You don't cry anymore. Emptiness is a concentration, and signlessness is another concentration. And the third concentration in the three doors of liberation is aimlessness, non-pursuing. You think you have to do something. You have to run after something for happiness to be possible. But with mindfulness, with concentration, you can already see everything is here. Every moment of your daily life is a wonder. To be here, to be in touch with the wonders of life in the present moment, inside of you and around you. Everything is done. You don't have anything to run after. There's nothing to seek for. The Pure Land of the Buddha, the Kingdom of God, happiness are right here. Right here, right now. That's why in Plum Village we say, I have arrived. I am home. The present moment is my home. I have arrived. I'm not running anymore. Happiness is possible in the here and now. Because I have practiced mindfulness and concentration, and thanks to those, I can get in touch with the wonders of the earth, wonders of the sky. So aimlessness is a concentration. The other day we spoke about vertical theology and the horizontal theology. Meditation allows us to touch deeply our true nature. Meditation puts us in touch with the ultimate reality, and that ultimate reality, we may call it God or Nirvana or Buddha nature, etc. Like the cloud, our cloud can get in touch with its own substance. It can touch its unborn, undying nature. And when a cloud can realize that, he just has fun all the time. So to be a cloud, we can be happy. Being rain, we can also be happy. There's no more fear because there's no more death. There's only joy. With the condition that the cloud can get in touch with its true nature, the nature of no birth and no death. Meditation is like that. With concentration, with mindfulness, we can get deeply in touch with the phenomenal world. And in touching deeply the phenomenal world, we can also touch the world of the ultimate dimension. Noumenal, just like a wave on the surface of the ocean. wave may suffer a great deal because of notions like beginning and end, rise and fall. But if the wave is able to touch its true substance, which is water, there's no more fear. It can be joyful on the rising and joyful in the falling. There's no more fear. Because the wave has been able to touch its true nature, which is water. We don't talk about beginning and end except as to a wave. Regarding water, the water, we can no longer use words like beginning and end or being and non-being. So free of those notions of being and non-being, rise, fall, beginning, end, the wave is free. Because the wave knows its true nature. That is the vertical theology. When you are in touch with the ultimate reality, you realize that everyone around, the other species, they are in you. And there will be harmony between you and others. So you have the relationship with the ultimate, and you have the relationship with everything around. So peace, brotherhood, sisterhood, and love are possible when we are deeply in touch with the ultimate we may call God, nirvana, suchness, etc. Mindfulness nourishes us, heals us. Mindfulness helps us to take care of suffering. Mindfulness helps us to cultivate concentration. And with that concentration, we will be able to free ourselves of fear, of hatred, and the other afflictions. And with these two energies, we will have right view. With right view, we can have right thinking. Thinking that is free of all discrimination. Thinking that is characterized by understanding, compassion. When you can generate, produce this kind of thinking, a thought of compassion, a thought of reconciliation, a thought of non-discrimination. This kind of thinking heals you and begins to heal the world. As a practitioner, you can produce this kind of thinking many times in a day. Thinking, we transform ourselves and we transform the world if the thinking is right thinking. And right thinking that is based on right view. There is non-discrimination, signlessness. If someone is dominated by hatred, anger, and despair, that person's thinking is characterized by that hatred, that violence and that despair, so that is not right thinking. A thought of hatred, of discrimination, destroys you. It harms your own health. Despair, anger. And that thinking also destroys the world. So as a practitioner, don't produce that kind of thinking that is destructive to your own body and mind and to the world. There are people around us who have a lot of hatred, a lot of anger. They suffer, and we have to try to do something so that they can get a little bit of right view, so they can produce right thinking that will help them to heal. And after right thinking is right speech. Right speech is speech that is based on right view. It carries understanding and compassion in what you write, in what you say. When you write a letter, if you are motivated by compassion, by understanding, the writing of that letter has a healing effect. As you write that letter with compassion, the healing begins in your own body and mind. And the healing in the world also begins. Right speech can transform the world. So a practitioner can always produce these kinds of words. What you say can nourish and heal you and also the world. So we should be generous in this kind of speech. Right speech. And there is right action. What you do with your body. This is the bodily action. To protect, to save, to help. That's right action. And it will bring a lot of happiness to you and to the world. Thought, speech, and bodily action. These are the three forms of karma. Three aspects of karma. Karma means action. So these are three kinds of action. When what we do with our body is action, but what we do with our words is also action, and what we do with our thinking is action. And action is our continuation. Every day we produce thoughts, we produce words, and we produce bodily actions. And it is the energy we produce each day, and that becomes our continuation. When this body disintegrates, we still continue because of our actions. Nothing is lost. Thinking, speech, and bodily acts are things that we do in every moment, and that's our karma, energy. Energy is never lost. We can transfer energy, but we cannot make it disappear. Cannot eliminate it, but you can change it. So when our body disintegrates, we still continue through our energy, the energy of our acts. This is the law of the conservation of energy, it applies to this also. If you are no longer manifesting as a cloud, you may manifest as rain or snow. Because it's still H2O. That's karma. So you continue. And when you're a practitioner, you really want to assure that you will always have a beautiful continuation. Because right thinking, right speech, and right action will help you to manifest in the most beautiful continuation. Jean-Paul Sartre, the French philosopher, he said that man is the sum of his acts. It's the same as saying mankind, human beings are the sum of their karma. You are your karma. You are what you think. You are what you say. You are what you do with your body. And nothing is ever lost. So we continue. And as a practitioner, we know how to continue in beauty. So after right action is right livelihood. A career that does not hurt other people or the environment. That will help us to realize our ideal of compassion in our livelihood. That's right livelihood. And it brings a lot of happiness. And then after right livelihood, we have right diligence. These are very concrete practices. Right diligence, a practice that we do all day long. Because in Buddhism we speak, of right thinking, right speech, and right action as manifestation of energy. In Buddhism, we speak of consciousness in terms of the store consciousness. And the mind consciousness. There are seeds buried in the store consciousness. In Buddhism, classically, we call these energies by the word seeds, bija in Sanskrit. There is a seed of anger in us. The store is like the hard disk. It conserves a lot of information. There's a lot of data in there. And in the store consciousness, we retain all our experiences. There is a seed of anger. There is a seed of despair. A seed of fear. But also there is a seed of compassion, of understanding, of joy. of non-discrimination, all kinds of seeds, positive and negative. And all of us have all the kinds of seeds. That's why the store consciousness has another name, which is Sarva Bijaka. It means all the seeds. The totality of the seeds. So a practitioner should know how to handle, how to take care of those seeds with the practice of diligence, right diligence. There are four aspects to the practice of right diligence. The negative seeds like fear, anger, despair. We should let them stay sleeping down there. We try to arrange, to organize in such a way that the negative seeds can sleep peacefully in the store consciousness. It means we don't expose them to an environment that causes them to be watered day after day. If you live in an environment where your anger is being watered every day, that's not good. So you have to use your talent to create that kind of environment where the seeds of anger and despair are not being watered every day. It's to protect yourself and also to protect those close to you. If you're in a relationship, you can sign a kind of peace treaty with the other person. My dear, you know that I have a seed of fear, of anger, of jealousy in me. And any time that you water that seed, I suffer, and I may also make you suffer. So please don't say or do things that will water those negative seeds in me. And I promise not to water those seeds in you, because in you, the same seeds are there. So this is a kind of peace treaty that you can sign. We have copies of them here. So the first aspect of right diligence is to not give the negative seeds a chance to sprout. But we live in a society where we are exposed to all kinds of watering, and the seeds get watered every day, so we need to reorganize so that we don't give those negative seeds the encouragement. The second aspect of the practice of right diligence, if it should happen that one of those negative seeds does manifest, at the level of the mind consciousness, it starts to make you suffer. When it's sleeping peacefully in the store consciousness, you don't suffer. But when something touches it and it manifests in the mind consciousness, then the landscape of the mind is no longer the same, the conscious mind. So anytime you observe that a negative seed has been watered and has manifested at the level of the mind consciousness, as a practitioner, you do something. You can practice mindfulness, recognizing that mental formation appear, embrace it, ask another seed. To manifest, we already talked about the two kinds of energy, the energy of anger and the energy of mindfulness that we bring forth. When the energy of anger manifests, the practitioner invites the energy of mindfulness to come, and that energy will recognize and embrace the first energy to bring some relief. This is a practice of diligence. The other practice is inviting a seed having the opposite nature up to take place, to take, occupy the space. And then this first negative mental formation will come back down to the seed. So it means when a negative seed has been watered and become a mental formation, we should take an action to help that negative mental formation not to remain too long at the level of the mind consciousness. We try to help that energy come back as quickly as possible to the form of the sleeping seed. And so this second method is to change the seed. It's like changing a CD. When you're listening to some music and you don't like it, you don't just let it keep playing. You just push the button, you stop it, and you put another CD that you like. And you have some really good CDs in there. You have a whole store, and you should know how to benefit from the good seeds that are there in you. Your potential, your capacity to love, to forgive, to understand. That's why every time a negative seed manifests on the mind consciousness level, you invite a positive seed to come, to embrace, and then that negative energy will dissolve and go back into the form of the seed. So the second practice of diligence is change the CD. The third aspect of the practice of right diligence, the good seeds that you have, you want to water them, help them to manifest at the level of the mind consciousness. In a relationship, you can also practice that with the other person. You say, "My dear, you know I have good seeds in me." And if you know how to water the good seeds in me each day, like the seed of compassion, of joy, I will be happy. And you also will benefit from my happiness. And I also promise, because I know that in you there are good seeds, and I make the vow to recognize and to water the good seeds in you each day. When I water a good seed in you, happiness is born in you. So this is called the practice of selective watering. We do not water the negative things. We water only the positive things. And in a relationship, this practice of watering brings the fruit of happiness very quickly. Just a few days or even a few hours can really transform a situation. So water the good seeds so that they can manifest in the mind consciousness and transform, change the landscape of the mind consciousness. The fourth aspect of right diligence practice, when a seed, a positive seed, has already manifested in the mind consciousness, we do whatever we can to keep it up there as long as possible. It's just like if I had a really nice friend visiting me. You know, you do everything to try to keep them. So the seeds of joy and compassion, when they manifest, we try to preserve them, to maintain them in our mind. So these are the four aspects of practicing right diligence. So in the Noble Eightfold Path, it is made of eight elements, just these here. If we apply this practice in our daily life, then happiness is something that is possible. Time for walking meditation in the sunshine. Please don't unplug your earphones if you don't understand French, because there will be announcements. Thank you.